From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Happy birthday, by the way, to avid Coast listener Mark Sorensen from Idaho. Have a good one, Mark. Later tonight, we talk about Bigfoot. Here's what's happening. An envelope addressed to President Donald Trump contained a substance suspected to be ricin and appeared to be connected to similar envelopes sent to the Pentagon. Two small pieces of mail delivered to the Pentagon mail facility have initially tested positive for ricin. Ricin is a highly toxic compound extracted from the castor bean. It has been used in terror plots. It can be used in powder, pellet, mist, or acid form if ingested. It causes nausea, vomiting, internal bleeding of the stomach, intestines, followed by failure of the liver, spleen, kidneys, and death by collapse of the circulatory system. I'm sure we'll have more on that story tomorrow. The FBI may wrap up its investigation into misconduct accusations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh as soon as late tomorrow, potentially clearing the way for a final Senate vote on his confirmation within days, one way or another. Breaking story today, tax officials in New York are reviewing allegations in a lengthy New York Times report that claims that President Donald Trump received at least $413 million in today's money from his father's New York real estate business, with much of the money coming through questionable tax schemes in the 1990s. The president declined the paper's request for comment, but a lawyer representing Mr. Trump, Charles Harder, provided a statement to Fox News that blasted the paper's reporting as highly defamatory and extremely inaccurate. North Korea may have obtained 20 to up to 60 nuke weapons, according to a top South Korean official revealing in what appears to be South Korea's first public assessment of its neighbor's stockpile. The U.S. Pacific Fleet says a Navy warship had to dodge a Chinese destroyer during a Sunday morning incident in the South China Sea. In a written statement emailed to Navy Times, the Pacific Fleet officials say the destroyer closed in on the USS Decatur around 8:30 in the morning local time in a very unsafe, unprofessional manner near Gavin Reef, making a series of aggressive maneuvers that were accompanied by warnings from the USS Decatur to leave the area. Charles R. Smith, who is our expert on such matters. Charlie, what is China doing?
This is a classic intimidation game that they've been playing along the Spratly Islands and in the South China Sea. They have done very similar tactics to some of our allies, such as the Japanese and Philippine navies as well.
What are they doing this for, though?
They have asserted the claim that the entire South China Sea is their territorial waters, and therefore any incursion of U.S. military warships or aircraft is literally viewed as an incursion inside their airspace and sea space. Of course, the assertion of their rights is counter to both the U.N. conventions that they've signed on to, as well as international territorial waters and airspace. So for all practical purposes, this is just an typical act of belligerence, and we have to be very careful to identify what is different between this kind of aggressive acts that are approved from Beijing versus sometimes the acts are actually independent operations, generally by an aggressive local commander who's trying to gain attention within the Chinese military.
And wars have been known to break out, Charles, with some stupid maneuvers.
This is not unknown. It goes all the way back to the classic incidents in the Cold War in the Mediterranean, where the United States and Russia used to play very similar games. When we came very close to shooting at each other, that's when both militaries actually established protocols to which we pretty much adhere to, with the exception of maybe one or two minor incidents that were generally not approved from the upper echelons. This, on the other hand, is definitely approved and given a great big thumbs up from the Chinese People's Liberation Army and the Central Military Command in Beijing. And that's a very disturbing kind of pattern. We've had their warships and submarines incur into Japanese airspace and waters. Along with these kinds of incidents, we've also had just recently a Chinese bomber also incurred into South Korean airspace and was intercepted by South Korean jet fighters. Again, these are belligerent acts. They are testing their power and testing our responses.
Good point. Charles' website, by the way, softwar.net. Charles, thank you so much. Russian investigators looking into the origin of a drilled hole that caused an oxygen leak on the International Space Station say it was caused deliberately. The small hole in the wall of a Russian-made Soyuz capsule docked onto the ISS was located in August and quickly sealed up, however. Wonder who would have done that. Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, who is one of the huge funders for SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, says that his non-Hodgkin's lymphoma cancer has returned. Allen was treated for this disease in 2009. It had been in remission. In this new statement, he said the doctors are treating it again, and he plans on fighting this aggressively. Well, yesterday we had a story about a new study that shows that dogs may become more anxious and possibly suffer from depression when their owners overuse their smartphones and ignore the pet. Well, I thought we'd check in with our resident psychiatrist, Dr. Peter Breggin, who doesn't, of course, school pets when it comes to depression, but he might know about this. Peter, this is a weird story.
Oh, no, George. It's a beautiful story. Dogs love us.
Of course they do.
And they're like small children, too. They also can just go into abandonment because they feel needy. My little Yorkie just wails piteously when Ginger leaves the house, and I can't even, generally, though more and more I'm able to, get her to calm down and just sort of sit with me. I think we have a lot to learn from dogs. For example, I mean, if our dog is getting uneasy because we're texting, what about our kids? What about our infants?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's a good point.
I think we've learned over evolution, social evolution, an awful lot about love from dogs. Dogs come into our community, 10, 20,000 years ago, and that's the same time we are becoming more and more civilized, more and more creative, more and more spiritual. We're burying things with us to go to heaven with, and we're using the afterlife. And I think dogs have played a big role in letting us know about needs for love and attention, and also giving us unconditional love. I just think that they're so much more important than we may think in how we've developed.
Peter, when a dog's depressed, what does this do? What are the signs?
Well, it's not so different from a human being. They can get off their food. They can just lie around. They can be not interested in things. In fact, animals in general will behave that way. Chimpanzees, if their parents die when they're only 3 or 4 years old, the mother dies, she's a caretaker, and they become depressed. But sometimes, say, an older sibling can move in and start giving love to the little one. So what we can learn from the higher animals, as we call them, is that we need to pay more attention to the needs of human beings and children. Stop making believe that we're all suffering from fake biochemical imbalances. And instead recognize that humans are probably even more sensitive and in need of relationship and love and attention than our dogs and cats and chimpanzees. We just the veterinarians are showing more concern for the dogs who did this article than our pediatricians are showing for our kids.
Yeah, that's true. Peter, thanks for the observation. Peter's website, Breggin, BREGGIN.com. Climate Week New York is in time and place where the world gathered to showcase climate action and discuss How to Do More. It took place last week in New York City. It's one of the key summits in the international calendar, and it's been driving climate action forward since it was first launched by the Climate Group in 2009. In a moment, Steve Gorham joins us, author of Outside the Green Box, Rethinking Sustainable Development. Amazing story with Steve, so stand by on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We've got a great program for you tonight. Steve Gorham is an informative, engaging speaker delivering compelling, provocative programs to businesses, universities, diverse organizations. He's an independent scholar, researcher, futurist in the fields of energy and environmental policy, as well as a former engineer and business executive with 30-plus years of experience at Fortune 100 and private companies. He's the executive director of the Climate Science Coalition of America, which is an independent, non-political association of scientists and concerned citizens focusing on informing all of us about the realities of climate science and energy economics. His book, Outside the Green Box, is in my hand right now. Steve, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Well, very good night to you, George, and great to join you.
I was just mentioning Climate Week, which just wrapped up in New York. What do they do anyway?
Well, they had a lot of people there, a lot of dignitaries. Their goals from the website were that they were wanted to raise ambition, reduce climate change, and accelerate climate action. Some big notables: Tony Blair, former Prime Minister of England, spoke. Ban Ki-moon from the United Nations. Actor Hugh Jackman.
The Wolfman.
Yeah. The Wolverine spoke, and so quite a big group. Also, a big public relations deal. They claim 535 million people were reached and 300 news articles written. So kind of an interesting thing. But I would, and a lot of the folks there, I think, believe that if they change light bulbs, they can save polar bears.
Mm-hmm.
If we all drive electric cars, we can stop the oceans from rising. And if we build wind turbine towers, we can make the storms less frequent and less severe. And George, we live in a modern age of superstition. There's really no empirical evidence to support those sorts of beliefs.
So they are definitely man-made global warming proponents, aren't they?
They are.
Well, I've never been a fan of that because, you know, I think one, Steve, and I think you agree, we're polluting the planet. There's no question about that, and we need to fix that.
There's real pollution we need to fix. That's correct.
But I don't think the pollution is causing what they say man-made climate change. I think we're in solar cycles. I think this planet has been warmer during the dinosaur days, and we didn't have cars and all the carbons in the atmosphere and anything like that.
There are at least four periods over the last 10,000 years when it was warmer. Matter of fact, it was about 2 to 3 degrees Celsius warmer, according to a geologist, 8,000 years ago, and we've been gently cooling since then, although the temperatures go up and they go down. And, you know, the other thing about pollution, as you say, many people are conflating what I'll call real air pollution that can harm people or harm the environment. Things like carbon monoxide, nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, mm-hmm. mercury, particulates, with carbon dioxide, which is a odorless, harmless, invisible gas. And when I speak to groups, I like to say to them, what do cannabis growers know that climate scientists apparently don't know?
Why do you believe that there are so many proponents for man-made climate change?
Well, it's a bit of a long story. Back in 1988, Dr. James Hansen of NASA came and testified before Congress, and it was on a very hot summer day, and he said he was 99% sure that the Earth was warming and humans were causing it. He was a computer modeler, and within a year and a half, the United Nations formed the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and just 3 years later, we had 41 nations and the European a community sign a treaty saying they would reduce greenhouse gases. So in my opinion, the first thing is that the world kind of jumped to a conclusion quickly on this. But, you know, for the last 30 years or so, the computer models have been predicting very fast warming, and we haven't seen it. Temperatures have warmed just a little. Storms aren't stronger. The polar bears are doing fine. And then the second factor, though, is I think much of this is being driven forward by momentum, by money.
Mm-hmm.
We have wind and solar and biofuel industries. We have deans of sustainability at universities, vice presidents of sustainability corporations. And there are over $250 billion a year spent every year on renewables to try and stop the planet from warming. So the first is the world jumped to a conclusion. Second is there's just a huge amount of money momentum behind all of this.
It's amazing what's been going on. And lately, the last couple of days, they've been talking about fears of 1 or 2 degrees affecting everything. What's going on with that?
Well, you know, that is really remarkable, too. Jay Inslee, governor of Washington State, just posted an article in CNN, quote, "How to Show Trump You Care About Climate Change." And he's made statements saying that the forests are a lot warmer, and that's why we're seeing these forest fires. Well, we've had 1 degree of warming in the last 130 years. 1 degree.
1 degree.
That's it.
And I think it came from the sun.
Well, I think
obvious.
So, too. But that comes straight from the climate research unit at East Anglia in England, the number one authority on this. 1 degree. So in the last decade, maybe we've had a tenth of a degree in Washington forests. And to say that all these forest fires are caused by a tenth of a degree change, I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. So people need to get a little perspective. There's probably other bigger factors at work, the way we take care of our forests, for example.
Are you concerned, Steve, that we're headed down the wrong direction here with climate change?
Oh, absolutely. This is a tremendous misallocation of resources. As you say, there are major pollution issues to be solved. Today, 80% of the world's wastewater is discharged untreated into lakes, rivers, and streams, the ocean. If you remember a few years ago in Brazil, the swimmers didn't want to swim in the water, and they're just building their first water treatment plants down in Brazil. So that's a real problem we need to solve. We have 2 billion people trying to live on $2 a day. 1.2 billion don't have electricity. We have 2.5 billion without proper sanitation. Millions die from disease. Yet we're spending all this money to try and keep the planet from warming. And the bottom line is the planet is dominated by natural factors, as you say, oceans, weather, driven by the sun. It's unlikely that we're going to be able to make a measurable difference with all the things they're doing in California and everywhere else on global temperatures.
There's no question that the groups that are pro or con what's happening with climate change keep butting heads. But I'm beginning to see at least more scientists beginning to feel the way you do, that we're dealing with a different kind of climate change.
Well, if you look at any of the predictions about climate change, and you see a lot of articles. You saw articles written about Hurricane Florence.
Mm-hmm.
And last year we had a couple major hurricanes. We had Harvey hit Texas. We had another one hit, I think it was Irma hit Florida. But if you look back at history, this has happened before. We've had 12 years since 1900 when two or more major hurricanes have made landfall in the United States. This is really nothing new. 170 hurricanes made landfall during the 20th century. And if you look at the actual evidence, you don't see that storms are either getting more frequent or stronger. The U.S. government also has data on droughts and floods. If you look for the lower 48 states over the last 100 years, there's no indication we're seeing more floods or more droughts. We had more droughts in the 1930s. We have three times the polar bears that we had in 1960. So the dire consequences are just not occurring as people are predicting, and people still write these articles, but they never show data comparing the past to the present.
When we come back, let's talk specifically about your new book, Outside the Green Box, Steve. Steve's website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I'll spell it for you. First name, Steve, GOREHAM.com, SteveGorham.com. The emails are flooding in for our annual Ghost to Ghost show. Now, look, we're going to take a lot of phone calls from you that night. But what we also do that is very special is we will take your emails of your ghost stories, and Tom is collecting them.
Folks, send us your stories. We need them. Halloween is coming up. So you can email your stories, give us a good story, and give us your phone number, halloweenstory@coasttocoastam.com. halloweenstory@coasttocoastam.com.
And what kind of info do you want from people?
Just all we need is the story and their phone number.
Simple as that.
Yep.
You'll get back at them. And generally, like last year, how many email stories got on the air?
Like a percentage, you're saying?
Yeah. So if you get 1,000 emails, do you get like 20 of them on the show?
Between calls and emails, we usually get about 4 email stories on in an hour.
Because Ghost to Ghost will be a full 3-hour
Correct.
Program
yeah.
beginning in the second, third, and fourth hour of the show.
Yeah, so we get a lot of ghost stories, but we probably get through about 15.
All right, super. Thanks, Tom. We're going to come back in a moment more with Steve Gorm as we talk about his work outside the green box. And welcome back to Coast. We'll take your calls next hour, regardless of your thoughts on whether there's global warming, climate change. We don't muffle you because people have different views. Steve, the book, Outside the Green Box. Tell me about the title, first of all.
Sure. Well, this is a book that tells you what your green consultant doesn't tell you, written for general audiences and businesses. And one popular business phrase used over and over is think outside the box. So the point of the title was think outside the green box, because businesses today are really trapped in the green box of sustainable development. They are forced to do many things that don't really do anything for the environment. And so I go through what I call first the four horsemen of the environmental apocalypse, which are overpopulation, the idea that humans are growing too fast and populating the planet too fast. The second one is global pollution, the idea that we're increasingly polluting the environment. The third is climate destruction. And the fourth is resource depletion. Those four fears are really at the basis of all of our state and federal laws about energy. And they're taught in universities and taught in high schools. But if you look at the actual trends, you find out that none of those really is a significant problem. They've all been exaggerated to a very, very big extent. So I discuss the four horsemen, and then I talk about what happens and is happening in different industries, energy, materials, agriculture, et cetera. But it's a fun read. It's a color paperback and got a lot of color sidebars and a lot of great quotes, and also about 800 notes in the back so people can go deeper.
By the way, for its size, it's a heavy book.
Well, I don't know about that, but
lots
it's
of great
a fun
information.
Book. I'll put it that way. I also hired a cartoonist, got a nice cartoon at the front of every chapter, which kind of summarizes some of the stuff in the chapter. So it's a good read.
With climate change and with what's happening, I'm told that the United States today is the world's largest oil producer again. Have you heard that?
Yeah, that happened last month or so. We passed up Russia. We had passed Saudi Arabia about 4 or 5 months ago.
Amazing.
This could be temporary because Saudi Arabia is talking about turning on a lot of additional oil production. But we're growing very fast. The miracle of hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling has turned the U.S. into the world's energy powerhouse. And, we're the biggest producer of crude now.
Now, I believe in Thomas Gold's theory of abiotic oil, that the planet has got an abundance of oil, which was natural when the planet was formed. It's not just made up of dinosaurs and plants.
I tend to think that way, too. As a matter of fact, the Russians have said that for a long time. Well, we know natural gas can be created by all sorts of things, including, camels and horses and cows and everything else. And many people think deep within the Earth, the Earth also produces materials like gas and other things. So I think there's probably a combination of some that is fossilized fuel, but the others that do come up from the bowels of the Earth, I do believe that. So I try not to use the phrase fossil fuels. I like to use the cumbersome hydrocarbons instead.
Well, you know, one of my simple theories on why the abiotic theory is the probable theory is because most of the oil that is pumped out of this planet, it's way, way down there.
Oh,
so
yeah,
how did the plants and dead animals get down there?
They're finding it now below 20,000 feet of rock.
Yeah.
Some of these very deep wells, they find oil, and you got to kind of wonder. The other thing is a lot of it has been, you know, found in the polar regions, too, and those regions tend not to have as much plant life. But I know we have shifting of the poles and other things that can occur. But, yeah, I do think it's it probably is a combination of factors, and maybe it is being produced down in the bowels of the earth.
What is the argument about overpopulation and that it's a major problem for all of us?
Yeah, so 1950, we had this huge population growth rate across the world, and until it got up to be about a 3% per year by 1970. And the big reason for that was we had declining infant mortality. We had declining death rates as we solved all these disease problems. And so a bunch of people like Paul Ehrlich of Population Bomb fame said that hundreds of millions of people were going to starve to death in the 1970s and 1980s. But they didn't. First, we had a global agricultural revolution, and even though population grew to 7 billion, it more than doubled by 2005. We had triple the agricultural output. But the other thing nobody else saw is that the fertility rates have been dropping. The fertility rate is the number of children a woman will have in her lifetime. And back in 1950, for the world, each woman on average was having 5 children during her lifetime. Well, today that has dropped down to 2.5. That's dropped in half. And the reason is we have society moving from an agricultural into a industrial and then a technological sort of a state. We have more women entering the workforce. They're waiting to have children, and they're having smaller families. So none of this was foreseen. It all occurred. And the great news is that we're probably going to get to global zero population growth within about 50 or 70 years. And so we're getting to a soft landing on the population issue.
And a benefit yesterday, Steve, in downtown Los Angeles for the Red Cross and our affiliate KFI. And as we were driving to get to the venue, I saw things that I haven't seen in years, you know, because I spent a lot of time in St. Louis. I saw so many homeless people living in tents on the side of the roads with more garbage and junk strewn all over the place.
That's very sad. Was this in California?
Yeah, it's in Los Angeles.
Yeah,
and I'm looking at this.
Homeless people in the county of Los Angeles there. So that really is a tough situation.
Would you call waste dumped everywhere pollution?
It certainly is a litter problem as a minimum, but yeah, probably pollution. You know, the other thing though, if I might comment, the government of California keeps making housing more expensive. You know, you now have to, every new residence has to have solar cells, and I understand they're going to want everything to have a electric car plug-in. So you just add about $20,000 to the price of every home, every residence in California. Isn't really going to help the problem.
No, you're absolutely right. What would you recommend that people start doing personally to combat this situation?
Well, people and businesses, you know, actually, waste is actually a pretty good news problem as far as what's going into landfills. That peaked about 1990 in the United States and is now starting to trend down. We're doing more recycling. But businesses need to reduce real pollutants that we touched on before, nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, particulates, et cetera, not carbon dioxide. So the efforts to reduce that, really, I mean, again, carbon dioxide is what they're pumping into greenhouses in California to make their cannabis crop grow bigger and faster. It's plant food.
That's right.
The idea that that CO2 is harmful is crazy, and people always show you these pictures that where you have this dirty-looking air over China. If you can see the air, that's not causing global warming. All of the major global warming gases, greenhouse gases, number one is water vapor. That's the biggest greenhouse gas. Two is carbon dioxide. Three is methane. Those are all invisible. So if you can see the air, you got to clean that up. But the greenhouse gases are really not causing air pollution. So we need to get our aims at the real pollutants, air and water, and quit trying to stop the planet from warming.
Steve, you've talked about an upheaval coming in energy and climate regulations. What kind of upheaval is this?
Yeah, well, we've had basically a ratepayer revolt now in Australia. Just this last summer in Australia, we had Scott Morrison take over as the new
Prime Minister
of Australia. Malcolm Turnbull was turned out. And leading the opposition was former Prime Minister Tony Abbott, who has called for withdrawal from the Paris Accords. The Prime Minister Morrison says his number one priority is to reduce power prices while we keep the lights on. We had a similar thing up in Ontario. By the way, both Australia and Ontario electric rates have gone through the roof, more than doubled in the last 10 years. Up in Ontario, Premier Doug Ford took over. And within a month, he had canceled more than 100 wind and solar contracts. They eliminated the $14,000 Canadian electric car credit. And now we have five provinces opposing the Canadian carbon tax. Now, California has said, so we got two ratepayer revolts going on. California says they want to be 100% renewable from the power plants. Electricity rates right out there right now are 50% greater than any other Western state in the 48 states.
50%?
50%. Nobody, you guys are 50% higher than any other state. And it's going to go much, much higher. Deep decarbonization, many studies have shown, is going to increase your rates double or triple. So I'm predicting within the next 10 years a ratepayer revolt in California as well. So around the world, you see a lot of nations now pushing back. It's not only Mr. Trump. It's a number of others as well.
Are the ice caps melting or not, Steve?
Well, we've had a gentle warming. Again, we've had a degree in the last 130 years. And so there's a little bit of meltation at the North Pole and at Greenland. But the amazing thing is the South Pole, ice is getting thicker. I love to show a picture of the Amundsen Scott Station in my presentations, and I say this is the third station the United States has manned since 1950. Do you know what happened to the other two stations? And occasionally somebody will come up with the right answer. The answer is the other two were buried by snow. And they've built this last station on stilts. It's seven modular buildings, and they jack up each building every year over accumulating snow. And that's where 90% of the world's ice is in the South Pole. Climate models cannot explain why the ice is getting thicker in the South Pole. But on net, we've lost a little bit if you add it all up. But there's really no concern that we're losing large amounts of ice.
It's incredible when these stories come out saying that huge sheets of ice and have fallen off and the shelves are melting away and everything else.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, you know,
that's
they talk
normal?
About the West Antarctic ice sheet, but usually what they don't mention is there are about 100 volcanoes under that ice sheet. So it is possible that West Antarctic ice sheet could melt if we have big volcanic eruptions there. But this is not being caused by carbon dioxide. It's another natural factor.
What about cities that want renewable energy? Plus or minus here?
Yeah, this 100% renewables thing, as I was mentioning, the biggest problem with wind and solar is they're intermittent, and they can't if you're going to maintain continuity of electricity supply, they can't replace traditional nuclear gas or coal. When you put in solar, wind, you only get about 10% of the total capacity as far as adding to the capacity of your system. So if you want 80% renewables or 100% renewables, you have to build vast amounts of wind and solar, and people are saying batteries, vast amounts of batteries. So this means you've just added a huge expense to your electricity infrastructure. Some of the studies say that in California, for example, they're going to triple the cost of their wholesale electricity, and that's going to probably double or 2.5 times your total electricity on top. So this 100% renewable energy sounds good. Practically, it's going to be very, very, very expensive.
Let's talk for a moment, Steve, again about pollution. How bad is the pollution out there?
Actually, it's a pretty good news story, as I talk about in my book. You know, I talked about landfills. Landfills used to be a mess.
Yes.
Now they all modern landfills in Europe and the U.S. are lined with a waterproof barrier to keep things from leaking out. They're covered with dirt every day to keep rats and other vermin out of the way. Our air is very much cleaner since 1980. Our six major air pollutants are all down a combined 70%. Those are the ones I mentioned, carbon monoxide, nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxides. Our water is not where it ought to be, but the Great Lakes have been cleaned up. Many of the offshore areas have been cleaned up. In Europe, the Rhine River is making a comeback. The Danube River is making a comeback. As a matter of fact, the interesting thing is people say, well, energy use is a big problem, but it's funny, the nations that use the most energy per person have the lowest levels of air and water pollution today, and those levels are declining. So this idea that using energy causes pollution really is not accurate. The nations that are not able to put energy to use effectively can't use it to reduce their air and water pollution, and so they're in a worse state. So it's really a good news story. What we need to do is get nations to become more wealthy, and then they will start cleaning up their air and start cleaning up their water. And so it really is a good news story from a pollution point of view.
Now, what's going on, Steve? Because regardless what side of the fence you people are on with climate change, why is it so bitter as opposed to dialogue and, hey, this is my opinion and I appreciate yours? It's screaming matches.
Yeah,
what happened?
It is kind of remarkable. I've spoken at a couple universities and done a couple debates, but I get turned down about 10 times to 1. I'm going to be up at Grand Valley State in Michigan on the 25th of October at a little thing. But it's fairly rare now that a university will invite a climate skeptic to a climate discussion. So it has become very polarized. And
do you get booed?
No, I've never had a disruptive situation. And, you know, I'm always very respectful. And the theory is plausible of man-made climate change, and that we do have a greenhouse effect. But over the last 30 years, the data is showing that the climate models are wrong. They made some assumptions which are wrong. So natural factors dominate. And we need to go on reducing real pollutants, but not carbon dioxide.
Well, see, that's what's so important. People really need to distinguish the difference between pollution and climate change brought on by cycles. The sun is heating up. The solar system itself is warmer than it used to be.
Absolutely. The Earth is dominated by long-term cycles called the Milankovitch cycles, which are the tilt of Earth's axis changes over time. The precession of Earth's axis, are the orbit around the sun changes. And these are like 20,000 to 100,000 year cycles. They cause the ice ages. Then we have medium-term cycles every 1,500 years or so that scientists believe the sun causes. And those are the fluctuating temperatures that we've had. The medieval warm period 1,000 years ago when it was very warm. The little ice age in Europe about 500 years ago when they were actually burning people at the stake. They thought they were witches and they were causing the cold weather, and our modern warming. And then we have short-term cycles as well. El Nino is an example, an irregular cycle every 3 to 7 years. Cycles in the Pacific, cycles in the Atlantic. So the statement climate change is real is like saying water is wet.
Let's come back in a moment, Steve, and open up the phone lines and let people participate with you.